Hello, hello, hello.
Hello.
I decided not to start with good anything because I knew it would I would say the wrong time of day. So it's a really hard habit to break, a really hard habit. Okay. Well, I'm Catherine. I'm one of the people on the teaching team. And if you've been here before in the last couple of Sundays, you know that we are in a series called Stories of Liminality, where we are exploring liminal events and spaces in the Bible, as well as individuals who experienced transitional periods in their lives. Dan Cameron makes the slides, and I think Andrew helped him with this one, but I love this slide, just to that whole idea of liminalness and this idea of, we've been talking about the Exodus, we're talking about the wilderness, but just that kind of upside down feeling that you have when things aren't the way they've always been. And so that's what we're trying to communicate in this slide. We're all in that right now. Things haven't always been like this, but there's a way forward in a liminal space, and there's an opportunity for change and growth and all kinds of good things. So I feel very, very hopeful. Well, Andrew came up with a whole list of topics. And so you notice we're not going in chronological order because we picked the topic that we were, each teacher picked the topic they were most interested in, and then, of course, on the date that they were available. So we're kind of going back and forth in time through the Bible. But I jumped at the chance to talk about the Old Testament character of Ruth because I'm very, very interested in stories of men and women in the Bible. And I do feel this responsibility to flesh them out, to make them more real, to talk about them in ways that maybe if you're a traditional church person, you haven't always heard these people spoken about. I titled today's message, Should I Stay or Should I Go? Because as I was reading the book of Ruth, that song from The Clash just kept popping up all the time throughout the story. The book of Ruth is primarily the story of two women. They're both widows, Ruth and her mother-in-law, Naomi. And the version of the story that I was taught in Sunday school and through sermons was pretty sappy, pretty syrupy, and completely overlooked what I find in the story now, which is the grittiness and the desperation. So I'm going to, I call the previous version the Hallmark Channel movie version. And we're going to talk about the real version today. The book of Ruth is actually kind of interesting. It's just four chapters, and God is never an active person or an active player in the book. He's mentioned, but he's not doing anything. So it's kind of cool. It's a very quick read. The story takes place after the Exodus, after the wilderness, after the time of the Israelites conquering Canaan. But now they've settled in the new land. It's the time of judges. It's actually a really rough time. It's kind of lawless. It's scary. It's before they have their first king, Saul. So during this time, a family that lived in Bethlehem in Judah migrated out of Judah because there was a famine in the land due to drought. And the father and the landowner, the farmer, was Elimelech. The mother, his wife, was Naomi. And their two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. So they move to Moab, which was formerly Canaanite land. And as the two sons got older, they married Moabite women. One woman was named Orpah, and the other woman was named Ruth. And about 10 years later, both sons died, and the husband had died previous to that. So Naomi is left without a husband or sons, but she does have two daughter-in-laws, both foreign, both childless. Now, two things were very, very important in Israel's culture: land and children. And at this point in the story, Naomi has neither. There is nothing of value in her mind, in her life. Well, a little bit later, after the death of her sons, Naomi learns that the famine in Judah has ended, and so she decides to return home to Israel. And her daughters-in-law, Orpah and Ruth, decide to accompany her back to Judah. And they prepare for this very long and very dangerous journey and to set out and return to Judah. And early in the journey, Naomi turns to both of her daughters-in-law and says, go back. Oopsie. We should be on slide 3 unless I messed up. Okay. Go back to your homes, my daughters. This is a painting by Chagall, a watercolor of this story. No, that's not right. Yes, it is. Yes, it is, Chagall. Sorry. All of a sudden I went, wait a minute. Okay. She says, go back to your homes, my daughters. What possible reason would you have for returning with me? Do you think there are more sons inside of me? Will you marry these unborn sons? Listen to me, daughters, and go back. I am too old. I will not marry again because I cannot conceive. But even if I could, if I still believed there was hope for me, or if I had a husband and conceived sons tonight, would you waste a lifetime waiting for them to grow up? Would you let this hope for the future keep you from remarrying now? Of course not, my dear daughters. It's obvious that the Eternal has acted against me. My life is much too bitter for you to share. Naomi is referring, when she's talking about sons to marry Orpah and Ruth, what is called levirate marriage, where if a husband died, his brothers, one of the brothers would marry the widow. And so that the son or child that would be born would be actually as if they were the child of the first husband. So it was a way to continue the line. So she, a way to carry on the family line. So that's what Naomi is referring to when she says, I can't conceive, and even if I could, I have no sons to give you. Anyway, Orpah, one of the daughters-in-law, she sees the wisdom of what Naomi says. Orpah realizes that a widowed, childless Moabite woman isn't going to find a husband in Judah. So Orpah returns to Moab, back to her family home. But the other daughter-in-law, Ruth, also recently widowed, gives an impassioned speech to Naomi. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, your God, my God. And Ruth accompanies her widowed mother-in-law, Naomi, all the way back to the land of Israel. And there, in the Hallmark movie version, the brave and beautiful Ruth catches the eye of the eligible and wealthy bachelor Boaz. And she does this by working tirelessly, gleaning grain in his fields. Boaz takes pity on her. He tells his crew managers to keep her safe from the men who would bother her in the fields. And he tells Ruth, just work alongside the female workers so that you'll be safe. And he tells his harvesters to leave extra grain behind so that she and Naomi will have more than enough to eat. And Boaz also provides water and a midday meal for Ruth, but not for the other people that are gleaning. And he says he does this because he respects what she's doing for Naomi, how she cares for Naomi. And then one magical night, when Boaz and Ruth are together in the grain threshing area, they fall in love. They marry and have a son, Obed, who we learn in the story has a son named Jesse, who has a son named David, who became king of Israel. So sweet. Hallmark Channel movie material. Except it was nothing like that. I'm going to try to fill in some of the real-life details. In Judah, Naomi and her husband had land. He was most likely a farmer, and they had enough land to grow food for themselves and also to sell. But of course, during the drought that caused the famine, nothing could grow. So their family was literally starving. There was no food to put on the table. And many, many families in Judah were starving at this time. And as I said before, it was the time of the judges. It was very lawless. There was no safety net for anybody. They were unable to feed themselves, unable to grow anything to sell. And so this family chooses to move to Moab. And when I tell you a little bit more about Moab, you're going to realize how desperate they were to move to this place. Moab was their historical enemy. So Judah is on the left. The pink blob is Moab on the other side of the Dead Sea. Moab was their historical enemy. During the settlement of Canaan, the Israelites killed thousands of Moabite men, women, and children. Moab was a land where multiple gods were worshipped, where human sacrifice was practiced, and where a different language was spoken. To get there, Naomi's husband had to sell everything they owned, including the family farm. And they could not own land in Moab, so the family most likely lived on the money they received on the farm until that money ran out, and then on what little the father and sons could bring in by working for others. They did make a living, and the sons grew up and married Moabite women, even though the book of Deuteronomy especially prohibits Israelites from marrying Moabites. But then tragedy strikes, and the three men die, husband and sons, and Naomi decides to return to Judah. She may be hoping that someone from her husband's family will step up as a kinsman redeemer. So this was the custom. If ever a landowner needed to sell his land for money, his closest relative, called the kinsman redeemer, was supposed to buy back the land for him. And the same was true if a man had to sell his own family into indentured servitude. The kinsman redeemer was to buy back the family. And the idea is that this system of a kinsman redeemer reflects God's relationship with Israel. The way God saves his people, the Israelites are meant to save their families and to save the land. Well, when Naomi tells her daughters-in-law they should stay in Moab because they have a better... This one is a watercolor by Salvador Dali. Is that what you think of when you think of Dali? He painted this biblical scene. All right, sorry. When Naomi tells her daughters-in-law that they should stay in Moab because they have a better chance of finding husbands there than in Judah, she is correct. But some scholars think Naomi hopes that once back in Judah, a kinsman redeemer will step up and return the land to her. And Naomi could be concerned that bringing two Moabite daughters-in-law with her back to Judah will complicate matters. And as we find out later in the story, she's not wrong. But at any rate, Orpah decides to return to her parents, but Ruth, in a very heartfelt speech, convinces Naomi to let her go with her to Judah. So Naomi and Ruth are walking a long way toward an unknown future, crossing the journey from Moab to Judah. It was extremely dangerous for women to travel without the protection of men, and they're taking just a huge personal safety risk to do this. But a border is also a threshold, a liminal space. Life is going to change for both of them when they cross the border from Moab to Judah. Naomi will no longer be an immigrant as she was in Moab. However, Ruth will be an immigrant in Judah. When they arrive in Bethlehem, it causes quite a stir. The women of the town approach them. Oh my gosh, can this be Naomi? It's been so long, back after all these years. And Naomi responds, "Do not call me Naomi. That word means pleasant. Call me Mara, for the Almighty has dwelt bitterly with me." Mara means bitter. Naomi says to the women, "I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty." So poor Ruth, she's standing right there. But Naomi only sees emptiness. And the writer of Ruth goes on to add, "So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, arriving in Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning." Here, and throughout the rest of the book, Ruth is always identified as the Moabite. No one calls her by name without appending the words, the Moabite. She's been part of Naomi's family for over a decade, yet she remains the Moabite. Ruth occupies a liminal space in Judah. She's consistently othered, consistently identified as different. And she is also, like Naomi, husbandless and sonless. And in ancient Near Eastern society, where the value of women was largely determined by their relationship to male relatives, this is a big problem. Ruth had already been married for probably 10 years and failed to produce a son, so her prospects of finding another husband are not great. And without a male relative, Naomi and Ruth have no legal ability to manage their own affairs. A husband, a son, or a father was needed in order to gain access to property, to open a business, or even to inherit anything. Well, in Judah, Ruth does what she can to provide for Naomi and herself. She begins gleaning in nearby fields. It's hard work, following the harvesters and picking up the fallen bits of grain that fall into the ground. But she's treated very well by the owner of the field, Boaz. In fact, as we've heard, one of the first things he does is to make sure she's safe. He tells his farmhands, don't glean in any other person's fields because you might be assaulted there. And beyond the inherent danger of assault, she also faced an additional and unfair risk. For young single women, even a hint of impropriety with a man that the fields belong to Boaz, she is elated. Boaz is one of their kinsmen redeemers, a man with assets, and he has a good reputation. So she encourages Ruth, she tells Ruth, to spend the entire harvest season working in Boaz's fields, which Ruth does. But as harvest season continues and then begins to wind down, Boaz has done nothing more than just be very kind to Ruth. He hasn't said anything about stepping up as a kinsman redeemer, and Naomi starts to worry. So here comes the PG part of the story, or the R-rated version, depending on how you interpret it, a chaste evening or a seduction scene. The grain has been harvested. There is no more grain to glean. Ruth won't be able to provide for herself and for Naomi, and there will be no more opportunities to impress Boaz. Naomi is desperate, so she hatches a plan. She tells Ruth to wash herself, to perfume herself, to take off her widow's clothing and put on her nicest, best clothing. Naomi knows that Boaz, being the responsible landowner that he is, will spend the night in a structure that holds the grain to prevent it from being stolen. She tells Ruth to hide in the building until Boaz has finished and eating and drinking and the big harvest party is over. And Naomi tells her, once he falls asleep, go lay at his feet. When he wakes up, do whatever he tells you to do. Naomi is asking a lot of Ruth here. People already have a mixed opinion of Ruth, a mixed view of Ruth. Sure, she's helping Naomi, but she's a Moabite. What if Ruth is seen entering or leaving the building? What if Ruth ends up pregnant? What if Boaz is appalled by Ruth's behavior? But she goes down to the threshing floor, and she follows through with what her mother-in-law told her to do. She waits for Boaz to finish eating and drinking, makes sure he's in good spirits. He makes his way to the end of a pile of grain, and he lays down there to sleep. And then very quietly, while he's sleeping, Ruth sneaks up to where he's laying down. She uncovers his feet and lays down at his feet. And later, sometime in the middle of the night, Boaz is startled. He wakes up. When he rolls over and looked around, he discovered there's a woman lying at his feet. Who are you? She replies, I'm your servant, Ruth. Spread out the hem of your garment so that it covers your servant. You are a near relative of our family. Then he says, may the Eternal bless you, my daughter, for the loyal love you are showing to Naomi. This is even greater than what you showed before. You've not pursued a younger man, either a rich one or a poor one. I will do everything you ask. Everyone in this city agrees you are a woman of virtuous character. You are right that I am in line as a near relative of your family, but I am not the only one, nor the most likely. There is another man who is more closely related to Naomi than I am. Spend the rest of the night here. In the morning, I will give him the chance to act as your kinsman redeemer and redeem you and your family. If he's willing to do this, good, but if he is not willing to fulfill his responsibility, Then I promise I will redeem your family by marrying you. Now remain here until morning comes. So Ruth lay at his feet until early morning. Then she got up while it was still dark, before she could be recognized by anyone, because Boaz knew that no one should find out that she had spent the night on the threshing room floor. Did you notice that Ruth didn't merely obey Naomi here? Ruth boldly went past Naomi's instructions to do whatever Boaz tells you to do. When Ruth says, "Spread out the hem of your garment so that it covers your servant," she is telling Boaz she is available for marriage. It really is a marriage proposal from Ruth to Boaz. And she is the one that reminds Boaz of his kinsman redeemer role when she says, "You are a near relative of Naomi's family." Now, a lot of ink has been spilled over the did they or did they not sleep together. And surprise, biblical scholars do not agree. So you get to choose how you want to read it. Is it PG or is it R-rated? But I can guarantee you, whatever you choose, approximately 50% of the people who know the story will agree with you and 50% will not. Then Boaz tells her to bring the outer, before she left, he tells her to bring the outer garment that she was wearing and hold on to it. And as she does that, Boaz fills her garment with 6 measures of barley, which apparently was a lot. And he handed it to her, then he left her and went into town to conduct his business. When Ruth returned to Naomi's home, her mother-in-law asked her what happened, and Ruth related all that Boaz had said and done. And then Ruth says, "And by the way, he gave me these 6 measures of barley grain, saying to me, 'You can't go back to your mother-in-law empty-handed.'" Naomi says, "Okay, we have to wait and see what's going to happen. But I'm pretty sure that man will not rest today until this is resolved." Naomi and Ruth more than Naomi, took a risk. They gambled on Boaz's character. Ruth and Naomi leveraged the potential scandal of a night on the threshing floor to inspire Boaz to take decisive action on their behalf. And it worked. The next day, Boaz locates the man who is more closely related to the father, Elimelech, and he says, "Hey, do you want to buy Naomi's land for her?" And the guy goes, "Yes, of course, I'll do that." And then Boaz says, "Okay, hold on, there's a little bit of a hiccup. Just so you know, on the day you buy this plot of land, you will also acquire Ruth the Moabite. It will be your responsibility to make sure she has children so they can carry on her dead husband's name and the inheritance." Again, Levirate marriage. This is how it would work. And the guy says, no, wait, I'm not going to be able to redeem it. I relinquish my right to the land. You do it." And then, I got to make sure I'm on the right page. Yeah. Boaz and Ruth marry. And they have a child, a son. And in an ending that seems very confusing, the son is given to Naomi as her child to replace her dead sons, giving Naomi an heir. So you can see it's a little bit more complicated than the Hallmark movie version, and Ruth herself is actually a pretty complicated figure. And scholars and lay people like you and I, we look at her and we have very differing views of her. Now, maybe you had one view when it came in, and maybe you're thinking of some other ways, but there are a million ways that people talk about Ruth. For example, Phyllis Trible she recently died, a feminist theologian. And she says, even in the feminist community, the views of Ruth differ a lot. One perspective faults Ruth for her perfection, for being compliant, for being self-effacing, for being a mere pawn of Naomi. Another perspective praises her for her faithfulness, for making radical moves, for risking dangerous acts, and for being a devoted ally to Naomi's efforts. And still others see her used to prop up patriarchal values of marriage and children. And then Ruth herself, after she does this, is discarded at the end of the book. A counterview sees her as challenging patriarchy, even while she's trapped within it. Her foreign identity is also subject to opposing interpretations. One view holds that the story affirms this Moabite woman, embracing her fully within Judah as the great-grandmother of David. Another view holds that this story rejects this Moabite woman, erasing her at the end by giving her child to Naomi, and so giving David a less foreign genealogy. Well, in addition to the should I stay or should I go, going through my head, the other thing as I read this is this word hesed, this Hebrew word. As I read the book of Ruth, hesed is a word that actually describes God's character, how God relates to us, unfailing, unconditional, selfless love, with generosity, with loyalty, with enduring commitment, with faith-filled grace. So that name down there, Rabbi Elliot Cosgrove, he wrote about Ruth in this way. And I'm not saying this is right, and it's better than some other ways you could think about it, but it's the way that this story resonates for me. Hesed, that word, hesed, in word and deed, is woven into the fabric of the narrative. These are Rabbi Cosgrove's words. We begin in the first chapter when Ruth, who is widowed as a young woman and under no legal obligation to care for her mother-in-law, makes the unexpected choice to accompany Naomi back to Bethlehem. The same quality of hesed, we would say, applies to Naomi, who extends beyond the call of duty to bring her widowed Moabite daughter-in-law back to her hometown. In chapter 2, having heard of Ruth's first act of hesed, Boaz extends hesed to Ruth, not only allowing her, a foreign woman, to glean in his field, but going the extra mile in instructing his staff, don't hassle Ruth, and leave extra stalks of grain for her to gather. Hearing of Boaz's hesed, Naomi responds in chapter 3 by coaching Ruth on how to endear herself to Boaz. And we learn that Boaz is under no legal obligation to redeem Ruth, their narrator sharing that there is another kinsman with a more immediate claim. Boaz responds with hesed yet again, releasing that individual from his obligation so as to take it on for himself and to marry Ruth. And our story closes with a final act of hesed, this one performed by Ruth and the community. Ruth bears a son, but our parting image is of Naomi holding him and the community announcing that a child has been born to Naomi. We don't have to choose just one vision of Ruth, one understanding of this very short book. There is no correct perspective, and I don't mind dwelling in the ambiguity. And I think it's good for us to think about biblical characters in new ways, in ways that make them more human and more relatable, and in ways that connect them and us to what's happening in the world around us today. I do think the message of Ruth is her character, her willingness to act on behalf of others. Boaz gets the title kinsman redeemer, but if you ask me, Ruth is the redeemer in this story. She enacts what Jesus spoke about. There is no greater love than this, to lay down your life for a friend. There's lots of grittiness in this story: loss, famine, prejudice, immigration, legal woes, helplessness, death, desperation, the unequal status of men and women. And these are issues in the world today. So for me, this story invites us to empathy and action on behalf of others. It's an invitation to us to practice hesed, to illustrate with our actions the same grace-filled kindness that God lavishes on us. Now, oddly, I'm going to close with a genealogy from Matthew's gospel. Slide 20, I hope. It starts with Abraham, and the genealogy ends with Jesus. But unlike most genealogies, there's 5 women mentioned in this one. And all of them have done something very unusual. Tamar was the daughter-in-law of Judah. Judah is one of the 12 sons of Jacob. She was married to one of Judah's sons. Her husband died. She knew she was entitled to marry one of the brothers. But her father-in-law, Judah, would not allow her to marry one of the brothers. He was afraid if any of his other sons married her, they would die. So Tamar, knowing that he has a legal obligation to her and he is not fulfilling it, tricks him. She dresses herself as a prostitute and goes, sets up a little tent by the side of the road, and she's unrecognizable to Judah. And he takes advantage of this street-side prostitute, and she ends up pregnant. And he does, Tamar shows up, you know, a few months later at the house of Judah, and she's obviously pregnant, and he's incensed because his daughter-in-law's clearly acted terribly with someone and is immoral. And Tamar, luckily, had kept something that Judah had left behind and said, "It's you." And that's how Tamar continued the family line. She did what she was legally entitled to that he would not do on her behalf. Okay, next one, Rahab. All right, Rahab was either a sex worker or she ran a brothel in the walls of Jericho. She's a Canaanite woman. The spies come, they're going to scout out the land for Israel, you know, is this the good place for us to go? And Jericho people are like, "Oh, we got to get to spies. We know they're spies." Rahab hides the spies. And then when the Israelites come to take over Jericho, they had made an agreement with Rahab, "We're going to keep you safe." So Rahab has this little sketchy profession. She also happens to be the mother of Boaz. But anyway, she's a woman who acted. She risked a lot on behalf of Israel. And so she gets included in this genealogy. All right, hang on. You know the next one is Ruth. We know her story, right? And then we're going to go to the next slide, I hope. Yeah. Okay, this one is Bathsheba, and Matthew chooses not to use her name. And a lot of people think that this is a diss on Bathsheba. And I have a totally different opinion. I think what Matthew is trying to tell us is Uriah acted honorably in this situation. He was one of David's generals. He acts completely honorably, and by putting Uriah's name there in contrast to David, Matthew is saying David was the shameful one in this incident. So Bathsheba doesn't get a lot of credit, and we'll move on to the next one. The next one, next slide, I think, is Mary, another young woman who risked it all by saying yes to God, bearing Jesus for all of us. Again, she put up with so much abuse because of this. So I just want you to see how, I'm getting off. Sometimes I get on a bandwagon. My husband, he's probably just about ready to roll his eyes over there. I think God likes gutsy women. And I will give it to you guys, he likes the gutsy men too. God likes men and women who demand fairness for everyone. God likes people who are willing to take risks on behalf of other people, who make bold choices to benefit other people. God likes people like Tamar and Rahab and Ruth and Mary. I think the story of Ruth and this genealogy remind us that the kingdom of God is truly meant for everyone. And there's no reason, there's nothing that keeps anyone away from the love of God. And the work of the kingdom, for those of us that have said yes, the work of the kingdom includes compassion and empathy and selfless love, especially in liminal places and liminal times and for people who are experiencing the harshness of life. Okay, that's all I have. The band can come up, and let's pray. Holy One, teach us to practice the difficult arts of compassion, of truth-telling, of shared sacrifice, the difficulty of hope, and the difficulty of hesed, and help us become the kind of people, hesed people, upon whom a beloved community might yet be built. Amen.